Welcome to the Student of the Game Fire Podcast with your host, Danny B.
Today's guest is Rain Gray, 28 years of career experience, Assistant Fire Chief with Buckeye Fire Medical Rescue Department in Arizona, creator and host of Fireground Fitness Podcast. The fire service wasn't on Rain's radar. He had a friend who worked as a firefighter and mentioned all the things that come with being one, such as the schedule, benefits, things you get to do and see while on the job, which intrigued Rain and started to get his mind thinking. After the conversation, Rain enrolled in the fire service program in Arizona, and his fire service journey speaks for itself. One thing about the journey is the experiences and mentors Rain has had throughout his career has undoubtedly shaped him to who he is today. It's rare to find, let alone hear, a chief who holds nothing back when it comes to certain topics and discussions within the fire service we discussed. I truly hope the listeners can take the time to hear Rain's perspectives when it comes to the best job in the world. With that, I present Rain Gray.
Day, thanks for having me on. My name is Rain Gray. I'm an assistant fire chief with the city of Buckeye Fire Medical Rescue Department. And my journey into the fire service, I've been doing this for 28 years. I started in a small fire district on the northwest corner of the Valley of the Sun here in Phoenix. Spent a couple of years there. Then I migrated over to Phoenix, worked in Phoenix for a little over 20 years, 21 plus years. And then I came over to the city of Buckeye, and I've been here for just about 3 years now. And it's been fantastic.
Okay. All right. My first question to you is, was the fire service always something that intrigued you, allured you, or was it somebody that was like, hey, have you ever thought about the fire department?
No, that's a fun question, actually, because it absolutely did not. It was not on my radar at all. So I came out of high school with, they kicked me out. They were like, get out, you got to go. And they gave me a degree, a diploma, and said, beat it. And so I ran off, joined the Marine Corps, spent 4 years in the Marine Corps, had a fantastic time, and then came out of the Marine Corps and was like, well, I've matured a little bit. It's time to move on in my life and do something different. So I started going to school landed here in Arizona, which is not where I grew up at all, and had a friend who worked in the fire department and also worked with me at REI. Do you shop at REI at all?
My Garmin watch, REI, baby.
One of my favorite places on the planet is REI. I just love all that stuff. So I'm an avid outdoorsman, love hiking, camping, climbing, and all the stuff. And one of my coworkers was moonlighting at REI, but it was a full-time firefighter. And we started a conversation about the fire service and I was like, man, that's a real job. Like, you can do that for real, make money, have benefits, all the stuff. And he was like, yeah, absolutely. And when we started that conversation, it reminded me of, I started recognizing different points in my life where I had been proximal to the fire service. So I had a friend's father in high school who was an LA City firefighter. And, you know, he told us a few stories. We saw his cool boots sitting outside the garage with the zippers in them, you know. And then when I was in the Marine Corps, I had a platoon sergeant who came into formation one day, all bedraggled and tired and beat down. And I'm like, what did you do last night? You know, I got partying or something like that. And he's like, no, as a volunteer with the Morongo Basin Fire Department out there. And so he tells us a story about this firefight, and we're like, oh, that's interesting, you know, whatever. And so, you know, as I reflected back, I saw these different points in time where I was, you know, proximal to the fire service, but had never been truly exposed to it. So yeah, it's interesting how our journeys evolve, huh?
Okay. All right. With that being said, what was your process to get into the fire service? Did you apply to as many fire departments as you could, or did you have one in particular that you were eyeing?
No, I was pretty ignorant. So I got back in the day, in the late 1900s, we would, we had to make phone calls, and we're calling different departments and get on the wait lists and get mailing lists for different openings, et cetera. So I was, every day I would sit down and make phone calls and try to figure out who was hiring. So during that time, I had gotten my EMT when I was in the Marine Corps at the local college, And because I got my EMT because I wanted to do search and rescue with the national park. So I was doing search and rescue, you know, because I was a rock climber, and so you know that made perfect sense to me. The alignment was there. And then you know, as I started as the hooks were set and I started getting into the fire service, I started calling around and testing with different departments, and was very, very unaware of what the different departments had to offer. So I was just out there trying to figure it out. And I was very lucky. The first department that gave me an interview hired me, and it was Sun City West, like I said, in the Northwest Valley of Phoenix here. And that was when I got exposed to the fire service. Once I really got exposed and went through the Phoenix Fire Department's Regional Academy, and truly saw the grand specter of what was available in the fire department. And as I began my career, just dove right in.
Okay. And I'm assuming out west, do if you're a candidate that doesn't have all your certifications, do they put you through everything, or is that something you have to do on your own?
Well, so out here to get on the job, you're the initial in the valley here in the Phoenix metro area. You got to come in with your EMT basic cert, right? And then from there, the fire department will train you in everything that you need to know. So you don't need to have like a fire one and two. Now, if you get outside the metro area, the rest of Arizona, there's the departments are still using one and twos, et cetera. And then they'll do an OJT type academy when you get on in those organizations.
Okay. And I'm assuming that you went through an academy.
I did. Yeah, I went through the Phoenix Regional Academy.
Okay. And how was that like being exposed? Because I'm sure there was a big difference between the Armed Services Academy and the Fire Department Academy.
Yeah, so I had an expectation that this would be like boot camp. And again, I told you I was very ignorant. I was, you know, I'm full of hustle and full of energy, but I didn't really know what I was getting into. And so I showed up spit shined and, you know, pressed, and everyone else was like, that's we're here to get dirty, man. That's not gonna fly. So it was a lot of fun, a little bit more laid back. You know, and Phoenix is known for Hawaiian shirts, you know, Chief Brunicini and the Hawaiian shirt. So it was a much more laid back environment. You know, all about the academics, learning the job, being a student of the profession, et cetera. But the spit and polish was not the primary concern, which shocked me a little bit because being a Marine, I was very dress right dress. Everything had to be just so. And yeah, it was not like that. So
Okay.
I had to take a wrap off.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. As far as once you completed your academy and you hit the floor with, I think you said it was Midwest,
Sun City
what,
West, yeah.
I'm sorry, Sun City West,
Yeah.
what was that experience like being a career firefighter?
So from day one, the thing that hooked me was that this job required a high level of commitment to be good at the profession. And that being good at the profession means that we are prepared, and this sounds melodramatic, but it's how I see it. We are prepared to rip people from the clutches of death. On the fire ground, when it comes to medical calls, et cetera. So the requirement for us to be razor sharp and to be capable, that really spoke to my soul. And so got into Sun City West, a very young and enthusiastic crew, and we were training every tour, just training all the time. And that was something that I thought was, you know, it resonated with me coming out of the Marine Corps, where, you know, I was in the Marine Corps during a time of peace where all we did was train. And there was no war fighting at that time for me. And so it was all about coming in, honing your craft, getting better at your job, so that in the inevitable conflict, you are prepared for what that looks like. And so in the fire department, for me, that feels like, you know, in the beginning of my career and on to this day, that to me is a priority, I think is really important that we focus on.
Okay. No, absolutely. All right. And so, how long did you stay at that department before you decided to go to Phoenix? And if I can ask, why? What allured you there?
Yeah, so so I stayed there, stayed in Sun City West for just under 3 years. And or thereabouts, it was my I think it was like 3.5 by the time I left. So around 2.5, I had made the decision I needed to move on. And why did I leave? You know, I had I like I said, I was getting educated in the fire service, and Sun City West was a wonderful little department, but it was a small department that served a age-restricted community, so just senior citizens, right? A pediatric call was like a 40-year-old. So
Oh.
I had become a paramedic in those first couple years of my career, and as a firefighter, as a paramedic, I wanted to fulfill the full measure of what this career could offer us. I wanted to do special operations. Like I said, I was a rock climber. I love playing with ropes and doing all this stuff. So I wanted to do all those different things. And as I looked, across the yard, and I could see down the, over into Phoenix, like, oh, if I go to Phoenix, I will get to do all the things. And as much as nobody wants to run pediatric codes or traumas or like these really shitty calls. By the way, Danny, can I swear on here?
Absolutely.
Okay. Nobody wants to run these shitty calls that can scar you. But at the same time, I wanted to know that at the end of my career, I had had the opportunity to do all the things that this job offered. And and that it proved to be the right thing for me. I went over there and had the opportunity to really dig in. The other thing I'm going to say, and this is going to sound kind of crappy, because Sun City West was a small organization and like I said, age-restricted community that didn't get a lot of fire. And I had aspirations from early on in my career. I wanted to continue to grow and do all the things that you could do in this in the fire department. And I didn't want to get promoted to captain or even further along and have never had the full measure of experiences. So it was so part of that decision was leaving so that I could get exposed to some other things. And so that if I did and inevitably promoted, I would have some seasoning that I could draw from, not just theoretical, but actually practical.
Okay. And I'm assuming when you made that decision, did you have to go through another academy again to learn the Phoenix way?
No, so luckily I went through the Phoenix Regional Academy, so in
Okay.
my initial training. So luckily they were able to direct hire me and just put me right in. I did, instead of doing the traditional academy and then three rotations, I did four rotations. So I buttoned up with the class and I did four rotations in probation. So I did do two probationary years as at the early set of my career, but that was fine.
Okay. All right.
Worth it.
Okay. So when you got to Phoenix, what was your first official like stationary assignment? Because I know sometimes they make new members rove different areas.
Yeah, so during that probationary year, you go to different assignments. You spend 3 months in every assignment and you move around. So I had a ladder company and then three engine companies. And off of probation in Phoenix, you go onto a rescue or an ambulance. We call them rescues, makes us feel better about it, but it's just an ambulance.
Right.
So you spend 200 shifts on an ambulance, and then from there you can head out into the field and go roving or get an assignment if there's openings or what have you.
And does it officially have to be 200 assignments?
Yes. Now that's something that they've played with over the years, but when I was going through, it was 200 shifts.
Wow.
So it's approximately 2 years that you're spending on there.
Okay. Okay. All right. So when did you decide how long? So it's kind of like a three-part question. How long, when did you decide, and why did you decide to start moving up the ranks in Phoenix?
So, it's a good question. When did I decide? Golly. So I knew early on, when I got on the job, I knew I would want to, at some point, I'd want to be a captain.
Okay.
And so I knew that was something in the future for me. And like I said, I wanted to have as many experiences and do as much as I could prior to that point. But when the time was ready or when the time came, I wanted to be ready. And so it was kind of like it's one of those things you don't know exactly when you're going to be ready for that, but when the time comes, you know. And so I didn't want to be left wanting when that time came. So for me, when I got into Phoenix, I had to do my probation, had to do my 200 shifts, then I had to and then from there it was just a matter of timing. And you had to have a I think it was 6.5 years With education, if you have a degree, you have 6.5 years, and it's like 7.5 years without. So I had come on this job at 27, had approximately 3 years in Sun City West. And so when I got into Phoenix, by the time I had done my 3 years, my probation plus my 200 ambo shifts, I was like, okay, let's get some other experiences here. But it's the next test that comes down the pipeline. We're going to start getting ready for that. So
Okay.
when I was doing my ambo time, I started going to school. I had been going to school all along, but I finished up my bachelor's degree and finished up my education so that I could, have that under my belt. As soon as I finished my bachelor's, I flipped right over and started into a graduate program. Again, just pipelining for the future. I had no dreams at that point that I would be a chief officer, but I thought, if someday I want to do that, I want to make sure that I have as much capacity as possible. And working with the raw material over here, I had to keep building. So I kept going to school and kept developing. And then, so the timeline for me, when I came off of my ambos, I went in and took an engineer's process, got promoted to engineer, started chauffeuring and driving around. That was a great job. I landed my first permanent spot at Station 39 in South Phoenix. And 39, for those that know, it's a little rat hole, and it's a tiny little station. It's dirty, and it's in a rough neighborhood, and so it's a lot of fun, a lot of
Right.
challenging calls, very very busy, and it's a fantastic place to work and to learn and grow. So spend, I think I was at, if I remember, if my math is right here, I was about 5 years as an engineer, and during that time, I took my first captain's test, and toward the end of that time there, and got on a promotional list and went out roving, working as an acting captain. And so I left my engineer spot and went to the technical rescue team at that point, took a spot at Engine 12. And so then I was on the technical rescue team working on Station 12, and then promoted to captain shortly after that. Well, say shortly, it was to a test later, which is its own journey in unto itself. And yeah, I'm not sure if I answered your question actually now
No,
that
you did. You did. You did. You're
I think about
good. Okay. All right. So my next question for you is with was when you finally made rank of captain and you were able to get some time under your belt, was it everything you thought it would be, or was it an adjustment?
So it's interesting because I acted out of class for 3 years.
Okay.
And so during that time, I felt a certain amount of impunity, right? I'm like, I'm just an engineer, right? Nobody can give me a hard time. If I make a mistake, I can make a mistake. So now that's not real, right? The reality is that if you're acting, you have a responsibility as a company. You are the company officer, and you have that responsibility and the burden of that responsibility as well. But it gave me a certain amount of freedom in my mind to, or at least a little bit of space to make errors and make mistakes. And so during that time, I really was working on developing who I was as a company officer and what that would look like. And all the ideas and things that I thought were important, I started saying, okay, this is my line in the sand. I'm going to hold that line. And I was able to start exercising that leadership and playing with that a little bit as I roved around. And then I was at Station 12, like I said, and during that time I had the opportunity to act out of class in-house. So that was a really great opportunity as well, because I had a fantastic crew that I could really trust to do their job, which made a lot easier for me to make mistakes, because I had a lot of strength in my back seat and driving for me to help support me in those decisions. And then when the ink got put on my shirt and I got made as a made man for real, it just sort of helped me codify and solidify what I understood about who I was. And in that first testing process, I came out in a position where I was able to go out and act out of class, but I wasn't promotable, obviously. And so it gave me 3 years to learn and grow. And I will tell you this, if I'm being completely honest here and transparent and a little bit vulnerable, that first test, I was a little big for my britches, and I was like, they're not going to promote me? What the hell? This is total bullshit, right? Don't they know who I am? And as I reflected on that process, I realized I had a lot of growing to do. Just because I had some experience and had some education and, what I thought was good seasoning, I wasn't fully prepared for the responsibility. So going out and acting for 3 years really helped develop my understanding of the role, the position and function, the expectations, and how to operate as a company officer, how to set expectations for your crew, how to understand the dynamics of the various different types of people that are on your crew and what their needs are. Because as a young leader, I thought, hey man, I'm the boss, I have a way to run business, and everyone needs to get in line. But the reality is that leaders need to address the different needs that your folks have. Everybody needs a little something different from you, and you need to help facilitate that, and that's your job in taking care of them. So yeah, in answer to your question, I wasn't really ready right away, and it took acting out of class really helped me grow and shaped me. And then by the time I was made, I was much, much more ready to take on the full responsibility.
Okay. All right. And with you being a captain at that point, what kind of leader did you want to be, and what does leadership look like to you?
Well, I think they're kind of one and the same, right? So what I think leadership looks like is service, right? A good leader in my eye is looking at has empathy and compassion, and is looking at their people and assessing what their needs are. And I think about Simon Sinek's book, Leaders Eat Last, which makes me laugh a little bit because that was, he got that from the Marine Corps, which that was my lived experience, right? Was this idea that as a small unit leader, your job is to put the needs of the men and women that work with you ahead of yours, like literally ahead of yours. So we go to the chow line and all the subordinates would go first. And as I progressed in my time in the Marine Corps, that became just the way you do business on a regular basis. You go to the field, when you come back, you make sure that your troops get showered and fed and briefed for the next day's operations before you do anything else. Then you go take care of yourself, right? So that same ethos, I carried that into the front right seat with me. And so, what do we want to do for chow? That's not my decision. That's our decision, right? We're gonna make that decision as a crew. Oh, you're on a restricted diet, you're eating paleo or whatever, we're going to figure out how to support your needs and help you get that. You get on the truck in the morning and you start running calls and you don't get a break until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Hey, you might have to take your truck out of service and go and get your folks fed. And you have to, take ownership of that responsibility, not just let your folks get trampled all day long and consider it a badge of honor. It's not. Take care of your people. So it's things like that. And then I'll even extend that a little further. You talk about when we start getting into keeping people alive, right? I hear people talk a lot about a round trip ticket, right? I want people to come onto this job, come into every shift, go home every shift, and live a full career and be able to retire healthy and happy. Well, how do you do that, right? My job as a company officer is to make sure that happens for my people. Well, in order to make that happen, that means I'm looking out for their emotional welfare. I'm looking out for their physical welfare by making good calls on incidents, et cetera. But also, I'm looking out for their training and making sure that they're getting to organizational training. I'm making sure that we're doing company level training, that our knowledge, skills, and abilities are beyond reproach, so that when we go on an incident, they're able to operate at the highest level possible. So the short answer to your question is, a caring, thoughtful, considerate leader who's taking care of their people. That's who I aspired to, that's what I looked at and who I aspired to be. My mentors were that way. And that's the type of leader that I that's the type that's what I consider leadership to be. And I will take that all the way up the chain of command into my role now. My job is to look out for the needs of the organization, but more importantly, the needs of the firefighters on the line. Because if they don't have what they need to be successful, then we're going to fail in our mission. So if they're not healthy, if they're not trained, if they're not in great firehouses with great fire trucks, we're not going to be successful in taking care of the community.
Love that answer. All right. This is a personal question for me, and I like to ask it anytime I get a person who's been in the armed services. I have heard a lot, fire departments are like paramilitary. I tend to disagree whenever I hear that. And, then other than whoever agrees, we have a discussion. And I think that way because I have seen countless times where a firefighter doesn't like a decision or something that has happened. And instead of going up the chain of command because they have a certain relationship with whomever that's higher, they go around that. Where, if I understand correctly, in the military, you cannot do that, correct?
Well, can and should are two different things,
Okay.
right? So, now my experience, I was a junior in the organization of the Marine Corps, right? I got out as a corporal, so I was a junior non-commissioned officer. Okay,
Okay.
so I operated at a low level with just with all the dudes in the dirt. So,
Okay.
for us, chain of command, right? You
Right.
stay inside your chain of command, and the private tells the Lance Corporal tells the Corporal, and on up the chain of command. Now the paramilitary, we talk about having kind of hierarchical structure, and so that's, to me, that plus being a uniform service, it's kind of where it ends, right? We have a lot more corporate structure, though we use chain of command, right, and pipeline it. But I think, when we talk about labor management and labor groups, et cetera, it changes that dynamic. You don't have labor representation in the military. So it's a very different dynamic on that level. You have a lot more representation and a lot more latitude, to your point, to do other things. Whereas the military, it's much, much more a straight line path that you follow up the chain of command. And the disciplinary process, there's no representation. You will get disciplined, and that's the conversation. There's no more discussion about that.
Okay. All right.
So, yeah.
Earlier you mentioned mentorship. So how important is it for either a seasoned veteran or anybody new coming into the fire service to find at least that one person? Because that's the thing with the fire service. There's all different types of personalities, likes, ways of life experiences. But how important is it for that individual to find someone that they can want to emulate, or they can go pick their brain and just obtain that knowledge and just to figure out like how they want to, who they want to be, and how they want to be seen within the fire service?
Yeah. So I would submit to you that mentorship is absolutely critical. And interestingly, at every level of the game. So it doesn't stop at firefighter becoming a captain. It's all the way through. I have conversations with my boss, and he has his mentors, right? And sometimes he just calls him a phone a friend, right? But he has somebody that in his network that he can reach out to and say, I've got to run this FFT, first fucking time. I got a new item. It's an FFT for me, and I need to walk it through with somebody. So I think your needs evolve over time, but as a young firefighter on this job, it's important to find somebody that you can go to, a trusted, advocate, a person you can go to and ask questions. And it may just be your senior firefighter, or it might be somebody further up the chain of command that's outside your direct line of reporting. But it's good to have somebody you can go to and have that authentic, open, vulnerable conversation with. And I think that I would add that there are different people in our that have different serve different needs for us. And so having more than one mentor that might diversify the conversation for you. So, because not we're all built differently, and some people have different talents, et cetera. So I think going to different people for different things is super helpful. And then I think for those of us who are more senior in time and grade and you know all those different things, we need to be receptive and create an environment that is permissive and allows people to come and talk to us. You know, we talk about having an open door policy, et cetera, but what does that really look like, right? So inviting people in, and when they ask the dumb question, like, don't make them feel stupid, because just because you know the answer and you've been there and done that, like, everyone's going to have their first time dealing with a new topic or an issue. So invite the dumb questions and say, man, that's an interesting thing that you're asking me. Let's talk about it, and really process with people. I think it builds the relationship, first of all, but also you're pouring in to the next generation of people coming behind you. So those of us who have subordinates, or even just peers that are younger than us, whether it be life items or work items or what have you, we have to be willing to share and pour into people. That's how the fire service is going to grow. And I wouldn't be where I am today if I wasn't standing on the shoulders of the savages who came before me and who were able to cut through the forest of crap to get where we are today. That didn't happen by accident. And so I would be remiss if I didn't stand on their shoulders, and if I didn't go to them and ask questions and then take what they gave me and do something with it.
For sure. Okay. Did you finish your career in Phoenix as a captain, or did you move up the ranks one more time?
So, two more times. So I became a battalion chief and served in a battalion, and then served two different assignments. I had Special Operations Division Chief, which is the parity with a battalion, and then I moved over to the 8th Battalion, which was a fantastic assignment. Really loved that job. And then from there, I got moved into the alarm room, the dispatch center. So Phoenix runs a regional dispatch center for the entire metro area. And then I got promoted to deputy chief in that role. And in our neck of the woods, the chain of command is deputy and then assistant and then fire chief. So I was at the number three level in the organization at that point.
When you got to battalion chief,
Yeah.
I've heard very often some say it's lonely. I'm not sure. I think Phoenix, with Phoenix, did you have a driver's aide or someone that drove you?
I did.
You did. Okay, so maybe it wasn't as lonely because you have somebody there that you can you pretty much bounce ideas off of. But was that a huge transition coming off the rig and going into the car for you?
Yeah, it was, but I got to tell you, I was really lucky. So when I came off and went into the battalion, I went first as a driver. So I went as a captain. We call him FITS, a field incident technician. Just a fluffy name for driver.
Right.
And I was driving for my best friend, who had gotten promoted to battalion chief. So I go in there with his name's Paul. Paul and I are peas in a pod, man. It was fantastic. So he and I were able to, as he's cutting his teeth as a battalion, and I'm over there able to really shore him up and talk a lot of smack and give him a lot of support. In that way, and the job of the way the driver works in the Phoenix metro area, the way we do it out here, is that driver is a part of a team. It's not just you're not just driving. You are there to provide support, and so you're really a support officer to that chief officer. So it's a partnership, and there's plenty of times when you're sitting in that car and we're both looking out the windshield going, what do you think? Here's my thought. Here's where that fire's running. What do you think about that? Yeah, I agree. Or, hey, man, I see it differently. Look at the smoke coming out here, and we're processing. So having that partner takes away some of that loneliness. Now, ultimately, when I was the aide, I would give all my advice and be like, well, it's your decision. You do what you got to do. And the burden is still on the chief officer to make a decision and make a call and key the mic and say the right thing. That experience was super helpful. And then when I moved over into that front right seat of the bat wagon, I pulled in a gentleman to come fit for me who was able to do that for me just like I did for Paul. So it's a partnership, which definitely helps with that loneliness.
Okay. All right. And how long were you a bat chief for?
3 years.
3 years. And then you moved up to the role of you said that you went to like the special ops side.
Well, okay, let me clarify. So I was on Battalion 8 for a year and a half, and then
Okay.
I was the Special Operations Division Chief for a year and a half, and then I was up in the alarm room.
Okay.
And
And
I was probably about a year in the alarm room as a division chief, and then I got promoted to deputy.
With deputy, were you over, I'm assuming, operations?
No, over to the alarm room.
Oh, over the alarm room. Okay.
Yep,
Okay. All
yep.
right. And having past conversations with individuals within your area, the way the Phoenix metro area alarm room consists of that, everybody gets dispatched through that organization, right? And there's no district lines. It's the closest unit goes, correct?
Yep. Yeah, and it's automatic aid in its purest form. So we always joke around like, hey, if you're in trouble and you key the mic, you could have 200 engine companies coming to you if you need it. It is that seamless. And so there's 30, I believe it's 31 jurisdictions now. There was 29 when I was up there. They've added a couple that are all part in the Maricopa County area and all contiguous borders. And yeah, trucks flow back and forth between cities. And the way the magic happens is that it starts at the base level. So everyone in the region is trained to the same standard. So there's multiple regional training academies. Everyone trains the same. And in order to participate in the automatic aid system, you have to have all of your membership has to have been trained in a regional academy. And so, in addition to that, we all follow standard operating procedures that are the same. So we call it Volume 2, which is the Phoenix Standard Operating Guides, and everyone in the valley follows this book for operational guidelines. And there's small jurisdictional nuances here and there, but for the most part, everybody follows the exact same playbook. And so that's how we're able to do that. Now it's funny because there's certain little nuances on the way far east side of town and the way far west side of town, little nuances that are different, but largely we could all pull up on anybody's incident and it's going to look and sound the same on the radio. And
Okay.
the behaviors on the fire ground are going to look the same.
Okay. A personal question. It's 2025, and shockingly, we still have areas within this country where it's you don't come play in my sandbox unless we call for you. Like, you're not allowed to jump this call. And here recently, I read an article of there was a fire department where a choking call came out. That station wouldn't have normally responded due to whatever reason, and they went and they saved a life, and then that jurisdiction that they were in, their chief officer was like, "Don't you do that again." So, like, what's your take on departments that don't do, and I understand like they may not be able to afford or do what the Phoenix metro area does, but having those to me, those dumb jurisdictional lines where it's like you have to get permission to come into our area.
Yeah.
What's your take on departments that still operate with that mindset?
Yeah. Well, you said it. Dumb jurisdictional lines. We are not here for ourselves. We are here for the community. And we need to remember that the human beings that live in our communities, whether they're adjacent or not, they do not give a fuck what city is coming to their door. When they're in trouble, they need help. And so for us to let our egos get in the way of the big picture here, that's a problem, right? We talk about, effective response forces and being able to mount an attack and do all this stuff. And if your department can do it all by yourself, great. But if there's a department next door to you and your units are all tied up, why wouldn't you let them respond into your area to rip someone from the clutches of death? That doesn't make any sense to me. Now,
Right.
I don't know any other way, right? I grew up in an automatic aid system where we just seamlessly do that. Now, I do understand there's times when I want to be able to cover every incident in my jurisdiction, right? I want to do that, and I understand the desire to do that. But when we're trying to mount an attack, right, we need as many resources as possible. And so depending we need enough resources to do the job that needs to get done. And if that means we have to ha get help from our neighbors, great. Let's do that. And so, they're firefighters just like we are, and they came into this business just like we did for the reason of serving the community. And so I can't support an idea of being frustrated with the neighbors. Now, if they're waiting on your borders and they're listening to your radios and jumping your calls and snatching, cool runs from you, I get that. But that's where we have to get into the relationships, right? And build relationships with our neighboring cities and work through the challenges of jurisdictional boundaries. But the old days of hiding plugs from each other like they did back in New York City and having different fire companies that belong to different insurance companies, that's not how this works, man.
Right.
We are here for the community, and that's where our allegiance needs to lie.
Okay. Love it. All right. So when did you decide, like, I don't want to say you had enough because that sounds wrong, but when did you decide, like, it's time for me to retire out of Phoenix? And when you decided that, was going to a different department on the brain, or was it, I'm going to retire and enjoy my life, and then an opportunity presented itself?
So, great question. So, I was not tired at all. I was super excited for what was next, right? So, pardon me, I had reached a point in my career where I was ready to take the next step. Right, I was like, okay, I want to be an assistant chief. I'm looking around, at the lay of the land in Phoenix, and I was at a point where I was like, okay, if the matrix in Phoenix isn't ready for me, right, then I'm gonna have to go somewhere else because I'm ready. I was coming up on 25 years in the retirement system, and I'm like, okay, 25 years is a breakover point for me between 25 and 27, and so I was thinking through these things, right? And I made a decision to say, okay, I'm gonna continue. What can I control and what can't I control? What I can't control is when people are gonna retire and what openings are gonna exist, and then who the fire chief's gonna select. I can't control that. Now I can do my best to try to influence and try to build relationships and try to make myself undeniable, but sometimes you can't control all the variables. So I sat back and said, well, what can I control? I can control my own personal development. And so I said, okay, what are some things I can do to continue to grow and learn and develop myself? And the Arizona Fire Chiefs Association was running a chief executive officer program. So I jumped into that program. I had applied for the National Fire Academy's executive fire officer program, but that program was going through its own problems and was closed down for a while. So I couldn't get in. So I got into the CEOP program. And with the intent of just continued personal development. And like I said, I could see 25 years was a few months out. I could see it. And I got pulled aside. Oh, I have to add a layer here. I had also reached a point in my career where I no longer held my tongue. And by that, I mean that in a good way. There was plenty of times as I was coming up where I felt very reluctant to speak truth to power, or I felt very reluctant to put my ideas on the table because of my own insecurities or whatever. But I had reached a point of personal maturity and professional maturity where I was no longer going to hold back if I thought something was inappropriate or dumb or not a good idea or whatever. I was going to say it out loud. So I say that to say that when I went to the CEOP program, sitting here with chief officers from all across the state of Arizona, and I decided that I was no longer going to be sheepish. If I had a thought or an idea about a concept, I was going to say it out loud and let other people give me feedback so we could have real conversations about tough topics. Things like DEI and recruitment and retention and you name it, all the different difficult topics. I have opinions and I'm going to share them and we're going to talk about it because that's important. And so, anyways, I say all that to say I got pulled aside by a fire chief at that conference and he says, "Hey, what are you doing?" I'm like, What do you mean? I'm heading home at the end of the day. What are you talking about? What are you doing?" He's like, "No, man, what are you doing with your career? What's next for you?" I said, "Oh, what's next?" I said, "Well, I don't really know. I'm kind of looking to see what's out there, right? And we'll see what happens. And I'd love to promote in Phoenix, but I'm also open to other opportunities." And then I got a lunch invite, And so I went to lunch with my current boss, and said, "Okay, what's going on?" He says, "Well, I might have an opportunity." And so being open to being open to other opportunities and open to continuing to develop myself, open to sharing my thoughts and ideas and being kind of unbridled with that and seeking real feedback in real time from people, it set me up for this opportunity, and that turned into a career change.
Okay. All right. So all these questions coming up here are directly related to, granted, directly related to your experiences, but definitely within your role now.
Okay.
So my first question to you is, when it comes to aggressiveness and you being an assistant chief, what does the term aggressive mean to you?
Well, it was funny. I think right back to firefighter days, right? So, go with me here, right? When I say to my firefighters, I expect them to be aggressive. To me, that means you are moving, you are thinking fast, you are thinking clearly and deliberately about what needs to be done. You're the space between your ears, that's 6 inches or so, that you need to be aggressive with your thinking and your processing. And then you need to act with the violence of action, right? You need to move with purpose and get it done. But you don't just move with reckless abandon. You have to be thinking. So I expect an aggressive size up, aggressive turnout, get your gear on fast, move with a sense of purpose, get on that truck, respond thoughtfully. If you're the company officer in the front right seat, you are getting on your right radio channels, you're doing a size up, you're thinking through what needs to happen. You're not just a passenger on the way to a thing. You have work to do, and you're doing that work aggressively, deliberately, with purpose. And the firefighters in the back seat, you're not on your phone dicking around on the way to a call. You're thinking through what's coming. What am I, when I step off this truck, what's happening? I'm looking out the windows, I'm looking down through the windshield, trying to see a header. What's the color of that smoke? What does it look like? So aggressive to me means doing your job with purpose and with a deliberate focus on the outcome. All right, you want to make a difference in people's lives? You're showing up with intensity. Now, I would carry that over into the office, right? Sorry, I'm looking around my office right now, and I'm like, hey, there's no light bar in my office, so I have the ability to utilize discretionary time as I make decisions. But I also have to be, I have to know when it's time to act, and I need to be paying close attention to that. So there needs to be a default aggressive when it comes to getting shit done, right? So at a certain point in time, we look at, okay, man, I've got a mountain of work to do. All right, well, what's the first thing that needs to get done? Prioritize, execute, and get after it, right? We're not sitting around. I don't sit around and wait for my boss to go, hey, I need you to get this done. No, default aggressive, get after it, right? And so it transcends the rank. It's up and down the chain of command. And what I caution is aggression. There's a great story that I heard Brunicini say way back in the day, and he said he was a young captain, and he walked into into a room in the fire, and there's a dude chopping the wall with an axe, and he's getting after it, just chopping, chopping, chopping. He's like, "What are you doing?" And he's like, "I don't know," but he was doing it with aggression, right? And that's stuck with me all these years, right? It was just this idea that know your job and execute with aggression. But without understanding of your job, if your KSAs are weak, you need to go back. Before you start getting aggressive, really think about what your skill set is, fix your gaps, and then be able to apply those appropriately.
Okay. All right. Love that. What is your take on outside training? Your members getting outside the walls of Buckeye
Go.
and exploring and then bringing things back? Because you have some organizations, they don't allow it, or if they do, it's on your own dime, your own time.
Okay, let me tell you a story, man. So first of all, the answer to your question is go to training, go to as much training as you can get your hands on. Be smart enough to separate the wheat from the chaff, right? So you got to know what's good stuff and what's bad stuff, but go to training. If you want to be a professional Whether you're a volunteer or you're a career firefighter, if you want to be a pro at your job, you need to be training, period. So, and I'll tell you a learning moment I had. So I was assigned to the Command Training Center in Phoenix in 2015. And it was 2015. Sounds, that's right, 2015. And my boss comes in and hands me a bunch of stuff on fire dynamics. And I was like, oh, fire. Mind you, I'm sitting there with a giant foam finger that says, we're number one. Okay. And he walks in with his fire dynamic stuff, and I'm reading through it, and I'm realizing that LAFD and FDNY and LA County had all been doing this research with UL and NIST for 10 years. We were 10 years behind where the major players in the industry were. And so I lowered my foam finger and I hit it, took it, put it, stuffed it under my desk and put it away. Because, hey man, we're not number one. We got work to do. And we as an organization need to be training and paying attention to changes in the ecosystem and changes in the operational context. If we want to be the best that we can be, if we really want to save people's lives, then we need to understand the operational context that we're working in. So, and the only way you're going to do that is if you get outside of your echo chamber and look at what's going on in the fire service around you. It's not all good, but you need to be looking, right? I just went to a conference just a little bit ago called Science to the Station, and there's researchers partnering up with fire officers and fire leaders and talking about how we can take research and apply it in the firehouse. That's amazing to me, right? So
Right.
evidence-based practice and using data to help shape and inform what we do. Now, you and I both know that you go into a firefight and you can experience some things. You're like, hey man, I know some stuff, right? We have anecdotal evidence for how things go, but we also have to marry that up with evidence and data and say, man, do what I think I know, or is what I think I know real, and challenge what we think we know so that we can continue to grow. You know, if you want to survive this career, you need to be paying attention to what's evolving and what's changing and adjust yourself so that you can be effective. If you're doing the same thing you've always done, you're going to run into a latent issue and you're going to have problems. It's not going to go well for you.
Okay, love that. Love it. All right. The next one that tends to sometimes ruffle feathers. I
Oh
don't know
boy.
why, but I think it's very essential to what we do. And that topic is physical fitness. You
Oh my God.
have certain departments that know that there's an issue. And I don't know if it's just the day and age, cancel culture, lawsuits, but we as firefighters know of an issue, know an individual that's just not cutting it, that needs assistance and help, but we just, it's like, I'm going to avoid that. What is your take on physical fitness?
Okay, first of all, this job is an incredibly physical job. And I know nobody, you know, we always joke around, oh, I'm a professional athlete. Okay, I would submit to you that you're an industrial athlete, right? Your job requires a level of physicality that has to be prepared for. It's a year-round evolution. You don't get a, there's no seasons, there's no on and off season. So it's a tough training environment, but you have to sustain your health and wellness. Now, there's a couple things here. One, physical fitness is important to the execution of the job on the fire ground, bar none. There's no question about it. You put turnouts on, it physically stresses your body. You're carrying a load. You have to work really hard. There's no question you have to be able to be physically robust to execute. The second part of that is a healthy lifestyle, whether it's nutrition, sleep management, et cetera, is a massive aid to your mental health, your overall health and wellness. And so we have to we know that sleep deprivation and some of the tragedy that we experience on this job has a deleterious effect to our mental health and to our physical health as well. So we have a responsibility to take care of ourselves. Now, I know, like everybody, like as you age, it gets harder, right? So what a 20-year-old's gonna do is not the same thing a 40-year-old's gonna do. I appreciate that, and there's science to back that up. And man, it's just real. That's real talk. You're gonna put on some pounds. So you have to make adjustments. You can't go in the gym and lift like you did when you were 20. So the 40s and 50-year-olds need to be changing up what they do and do it a little differently. But you got to do something, period. That's the conversation. Now, how, as an organization, how we assess that, and there's a lot of different things there. And that can get problematic because we say, hey, man, this is a job. It's none of your business how fat I am, right? That's tough. What I would say is, this is where this gets really sticky, and I see the challenge here. But what I'm going to say is that we talk a lot about a brotherhood and a sisterhood, and that we're a family. And if you care about me, you are going to help me get squared away. And if I am out of control with my health, and I am not going to survive this career because I am out of shape to the point of poor health, man, I thought you cared about me. If you cared about me, instead of just chirping at me and sniping at me and shaming me, you would sit down with me and say, hey man, I'm really worried about you, Danny. What's going on? You seem to really pack it on the weight. Well, my marriage and this is that. There's always something more going on, right? Or man, like every time you guys go in the gym and you're doing this CrossFit shit and I can't keep up and I feel like shit. Okay, well, what can you do? Right? Hey, let's try as a company. We're gonna sit down and we're gonna eat good together. Right? We're gonna try to make good food. Like, yeah, every time we sit down, you make these giant lasagnas or whatever, giant tray of, whatever fat food, insert crazy food here, right? Like whatever it is. But can you as a crew work together to help that one member who might be struggling with their fitness? Yeah, you can, but you got to give a shit. And so that's something that we are quick to pass on and say it's your responsibility, and of course it does boil down to the individual has a responsibility to act. I don't disagree with that. However, it's when the environment isn't conducive to that. And I'm going to pull back a little bit and say, okay, what role and responsibility does management have to help folks be successful? Okay. One, an environment where training equipment is provided, right? Give them access to some training equipment. Heck, if they need some out of service time, make access for that, right? There's things you can do. We need to really consider. And I know that this is a tough one, but we really need to consider and work through challenges with work schedules, hours of work, shift schedules, et cetera, because we know that sleep deprivation is really hard on our bodies and causes weight gain and all the different things, right? The stress levels, et cetera, cortisol, blah, blah, blah. So there's some things that levers we can pull. They may not be easy levers to pull, but we need to give good consideration. I was just talking to a city manager, actually, he's a former fire chief just recently, and their department changed the start time of the shift. So they didn't change their shift schedule. They're on a 48-96, but they changed the start time. And that the changing of that start time allowed them to get to sleep in the morning. So now their hours of sleep are improved because they can get an extra sleep cycle. When they're on shift, they get an extra sleep cycle. And when they're at home, they get an extra sleep cycle because they don't have to get up and go to work. And the added benefit is they don't have to deal with rush hour traffic because they moved the start time to, I think it was 11 a.m. So, and everyone's like, wow, but the training schedule and blah, 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 and the office hours. I'm like, are we here to provide the best service to the community? Yes. And if our ability to provide the best service is by taking care of the people who provide the service. So we have to find a way, and I don't have all the answers here, but I'm saying we got to really think through what we're doing with our membership and how we're helping them be successful.
Max. Okay, preaching nothing but the truth. Okay, all right. You kind of mentioned it, so I'm gonna hit on it. That whole wellness, truly being there. You mentioned that key word, that brotherhood, that sisterhood, that we're quick to use, depending on the circumstance. So what's your take on that?
Oh, I don't know if we believe it. I don't know if we believe it. We say it all the time, and at the same time, we will eviscerate a member of our organization. And so, I would challenge all of us to really think through what we mean by that. And if there's somebody in our organization, let's be clear, man, we hire a wide variety of people, and not everyone's going to look, behave, act just like me. And this kind of goes back to what I was talking about earlier about being a company officer and realizing that my crew, every person on my crew needs something different from me. Well, every member of your organization needs a little something different. And what the number one thing that we all need is a little bit of grace. Okay. We hire people for life in this industry, right? We're one of the few industries that do this. And so we hire this, I'm going to say like a 20-year-old, right? Someone in their 20s. Well, they're going to make 20-year-old type mistakes. And then by the time they're in their mid-30s, they start taking promotional exams. They become a lieutenant, they become an engineer, they become a captain, right? And then we all go, "Oh, look at Captain 180 over here. This guy, when you were young on the job, you were a jackass." Listen, man, we have to give each other some room to make mistakes and to grow. And so when I think about this idea of taking care of one another, it means that we're looking out for that. We're truly looking out for the wellness and the health and the training and the organizational health of our membership, right? And it's critical. I'm reminded of a time when, we would pull the carpet up and we sweep an issue under the rug. And we say, "Hey man, that shit didn't happen. We're keeping it at the lowest level, right? We're gonna keep it in the firehouse." But I'm gonna tell you what, man, if you truly love your brother, you will get them the help that they need. You don't sweep that shit under the rug. If somebody is doing something that is outside of organizational policy, and you know it's outside of policy, if you want them to be successful in their career, you call them on it and you correct them. Because if you let that stuff languish or let it go, they're gonna find themselves without a job. And they're going to be out of a career, right? So if you really care about them, you'll correct them, right? Same thing when we talk about drug issues or other type of problems that come into the firehouse, man. If somebody's struggling with something, they come in drunk. A lot of time back in the day, we just put them to bed and say, "Hey man, sleep it off. We'll come get you at, for lunch or whatever." Man, that is not okay because you're condoning behavior that's going to get repeated. And that person's probably on a really slippery slope. And now you've condoned that behavior. And next thing you know, that guy's finding himself without a job. Or worse, committing suicide or whatever the thing is, man. But if somebody's got something going on, if we truly believe that we are part of a fraternal order here, brother and sisterhood, then we need to start taking care of each other as a family, right? So.
When it comes to recruitment and retention, in your opinion, what do you see the fire service doing right, and where do you see the fire service can improve on? Because everybody's affected by this. It doesn't matter what organization you are, for we just don't have the numbers, we just don't have the people wanting to apply to be in public service now.
So it's funny, we just got done doing a huge study on this in Arizona, and I won't bore you with like all the details, but what I will point to is a couple of things that you specifically ask about, right? What are we doing right and what are we doing wrong? Some of the challenges we're faced with is people can't afford to live in the jurisdictions where they're working, right? So there's huge financial stress. When you look at a firefighter who's making $22 an hour, that's a problem, right? They can't afford to live. And I talked to a firefighter. We did a part of our study that we did was five and unders. We talked to folks that were 5 years or less on the job, and I had a 30-year-old tell me that he had five roommates. He's like, "Man," he goes, "I'm just disappointed, man. By the time I was 30, I'd have a house and a place of my own." But here he is living with roommates. And so I can see how demoralizing that is and frustrating. And then on top of that, the culture, we know that this job can hurt, injure, or kill us, right? And the things that we just talked about, sleep deprivation and cancer and all the different things that can come along with that, right? And then on top of that, you have organizations that are so thinly staffed that people are getting mandatoried every other day, and of course that's hyperbolic, but they're getting mandatoried like crazy, and on the other side, we are marketing this job as, "Man, you work 10 days a month and all this time off," and that's not real, right? It's not honest. The other part of this is we say, yeah, the recruitment videos are fighting fire and kicking doors and cutting cars. It's all the fun stuff, right? But that's, that's what, 80 to 85% of the job, 90% of the job is EMS.
Yep.
So the part we're advertising is we all love that part. It's sexy, it's fun, it's exciting. It's not the total picture of the job. So people come on this job and they're completely disillusioned. Or they express interest in the job and their friends who are on the job are like, hey man, it's not what you think it is.
Yeah.
And so part of what we're doing wrong is our marketing is wrong, right? We're not being honest. Where we're recruiting from, I don't know that we're doing a great job of finding the right locations to find people. So we need to think about who we want in our organizations, considering the bulk of what we do, right? That's part of it. And I think the other kind of insidious part of this is the culture in the organization. One of the things that was in the Harvard Business Review, they talk about the number one reason people leave organizations is toxic work environment. So that means a lot of different things to different people. But what that really boils down to is organizational culture and supervisors that are shitty, for lack of a better way to say it. Right. And if people don't feel connected, they don't feel like they're a part of something, they don't feel like they're wanted or needed in that organization, they will leave. So boss, back in the, we talk about how, well, when I was raised up, I was hazed and I was all the different things, right? In today's fire service, that's not acceptable. And it's not just the fire service, it's the world we live in. Those behaviors aren't acceptable anymore. And so the youth that are coming on this job were raised in a culture where that's not how you treat people. So if they come onto an organization where they're being treated like crap, they're being marginalized, or and I'm not talking about the basic stuff like, hey, your job is to clean the crappers.
Right,
Okay. I'm talking about being made to feel less than because they're cleaning the crappers, but then on top of that, you don't take them out training. You don't pour into them, you don't educate them. You're just here to be our house mouse and take care of all the menial tasks. We're not going to train you. That's somebody else's job, right? That's a shitty environment. That's not okay. So, what I would say is that organizations really need to do a self-analysis. Who are we and how do we treat people? And honest conversations with yourselves. And if you don't think you're having a recruitment problem or retention problem, stand by, because it's the culture is changing across the country, and people are not as interested in public safety as they once were. And that's also for all the reasons that we just talked about, right? They don't, people are real are hip to what we got going on and they don't want it.
Yeah, no, for sure. For sure. Okay. What kind of training? Actually, I didn't even get to ask this question, so I'm gonna do it now because I usually do, but I totally missed it. Can you tell the listeners a little bit about Buckeye? The size, how many stations, your amount of
Oh, sure.
personnel, just the, things of that nature.
Yeah, so we're at about 156 people right now. We cover 640 square miles out of eight companies, seven stations, eight companies. We have three stations that are in development. They're in the design phase right now, and one of them is a replacement station, and two of them are brand new companies that we're adding in. And if I'm paying attention to the horizon, we have other development agreements that are coming down the pipeline, so we're going to have additional stations in the not too far future. So we're often touted as one of the busiest, or sorry, one of the fastest growing communities in the nation, certainly in Maricopa County, and we're feeling the effects of that right now. We're in a very serious growth spurt, and which is fantastic. The city of Buckeye Fire Department is 25 years old. So the city incorporated back in the early 2000, and fire department came alive. It was a volunteer fire department before that, so fairly young organization. So as we're hiring all these folks right now, we're about to see some of our first wave of retirements in the, we've had a couple here and there, but we'll start seeing more in the next couple of years. So kind of a crazy time for us as we're building out and growing the department, but also starting to see people leave. It's a
Okay.
transition.
How many engines, how many ladders?
So, eight engines, one ladder.
Eight engines, one ladder. And I'm assuming firefighter EMTs or firefighter paramedics is the requirement.
Yes. So EMT is the requirement,
Okay.
and we have all ALS apparatus.
Okay.
So we have half our folks are medics approximately.
Okay. Do you guys have transport units? Do transport?
Negative.
No. Okay.
No,
So
we do not. That's the biggest selling point for
man,
us.
that's why I always like to ask. That way, if anybody is like looking to go to that area, so no
Yeah.
transports, but you are ALS providers. I'm
Yes.
assuming the county or the area you live, they handle the transports.
Yeah, so there's a fire district that's kind of surrounds us and is woven in a little bit through us, and they provide the ambulance transportation to our jurisdiction.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what's your minimum staffing across your apparatus?
Four.
Four. Minimum of four.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You only have one truck, so I'm gonna kind of, I would say engines do engine work, trucks do truck work, or with only one truck, do you
Yeah.
pretty much multitask?
So right now the engine's cross-staffed
Okay.
with the ladder.
Okay.
Sorry, the
Okay.
ladder is cross-staffed with the engine, and that's our one of the things that's on our strategic plan is to get that unit fully staffed on its own. But when they take the ladder out, they do ladder work, right?
Gotcha.
So, and it's not a quint, it's a straight dry ladder.
Okay.
So they do straight up ladder work with the extrication equipment is done off of our ladder, or extrication is done off of our ladder. And in our neck of the woods, we do vertical ventilation a lot, so they're up on roofs and doing that type of stuff as well.
Okay. And I know you guys, with the dispatch system you have, it's closest unit, but if a first due structural box comes in within the city of Buckeye, what's your first alarm assignment consist of?
So if it's a working fire, it's a 3-in-1. So three
Three
engines
and
in a
one.
ladder.
Okay.
Yeah. Three engines in a
Okay.
ladder, two battalions, and a rescue or an
Okay.
ambulance.
Gotcha. Gotcha. And I was gonna ask, you have two battalion chiefs, I'm assuming.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. All right. Like I said, I always like to ask the guests that way,
Yeah.
with the whole no transport thing, definitely ears might perk up to go, all right.
And we're running a process somewhere in the first quarter of the year, so that's
Okay.
coming.
Okay. And another hot topic, what is Buckeye's schedule?
We work a 4896.
4896. Okay. All right.
Not horrible.
No, it's not. Honestly, so have you always worked that? Is that the only schedule you know?
No, I've never worked a 4896. So I worked
Oh.
a 2448 in Phoenix. My whole career was that way. And then
Okay.
but these guys have been a 4896 for 10 years, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, they converted a while back, and
Okay.
they love it. The guys love it. Now, total call volume, we have about 120,000 people, and so spread over 640 square miles. About total call volume, about 11,000 calls a year.
Okay.
So not crazy busy yet. We have two houses that are running about 2,500 calls a piece, and then the other stations are pretty quiet. So it's
Okay.
kind of a that's where the demographics are changing and growing, and we're trying to strategically position to be prepared for that
Right.
as
Right.
these elements come in. So
Okay. All right. With that being said, my question to you is, I'm not sure what your budget is for Buckeye, but how do you allow your members to obtain the most realistic training as possible while on duty? Because most departments aren't burning left and right unless you're talking Baltimore, DC areas like that.
So we have a pretty robust training budget, and we make training a priority in our organization. Our little handle is training every tour. So our expectation is that we have a very robust training calendar for the department, and then the expectation is that crews are out doing individual company training every tour. So, and that's up to the captain to kind of assess what their needs are, what they need to be working on. Do they have a probationary firefighter or whatever it is, right? So they need to be making those decisions for their crew and developing local training for themselves. And then as a department, our training division puts on a very robust training packet. We do annual live burns. So that's something that is kind of unique. Not a lot of organizations are doing that anymore, but we still do live burns every year. So that's a nice thing. We have our own training academy, and we're working on a new one right now. The one we have is pretty old, antiquated. Yeah, we call it the pit for a reason, and we're working on a new training academy. We just got bonded for that, so we'll have some new training facility in about 5 years. So we take training very seriously. We also do special operations. We have TRT and hazmat. So every Monday is Hazmat Monday, and every Tuesday is TRT Tuesday. So folks are going for that training on a regular basis. And yeah, does that answer your question? I think
Yep,
it's
you did. You
yeah.
did. Okay. And as we wrap up, I'm going to ask you two personal questions. First question is, what is the goal for Rain Gray? Are you looking at some point to become next in line? Is that something you want? Because some individuals don't want that, they don't want that position, the title of fire chief, but what's next for you?
So, what's interesting is over the years, I was like, well, I don't really understand what the fire chief does. So I don't know why I'd want that job, right? Like, I like being on a fire truck. And so the idea of aspiring, no interest, right? But it wasn't until the last 3 years when I got into, my office is right next to the fire chief, right? So now I'm in the executive office and we're having conversations about the long range vision and strategic planning and what used to be kind of a would be kind of silly to me now becomes very interesting. And so having conversations about becoming a fire chief, my wife and I have that conversation now and talk about it in real terms about what that looks like. And I've talked to my boss about what that looks like, and he told me, he says, "Hey man, you'll be ready in about 9 years." I'm like, 9 years? What happens in 9 years? And he's like, "Well, that's when I retire. And you can be the fire chief." So he's very supportive. And I continue, just like I said before, always looking for opportunities to develop and grow and build my skill set so that when the right opportunity comes along, I'll be prepared. But I will say this, I love my job. I love what I get to do now. And so it would take a pretty sweet offer for me to punch out.
Okay, and that's what I was going to ask you, like respectfully, if you were willing to answer that, because you mentioned it, opportunities present itself. So I'm assuming you're not tied down to the Phoenix area if an opportunity were to present itself.
No, I don't think so. I think that's one of those things where we all need to be willing to go through doors when they open up, right? And so I will say though that in the second half of my life here as an older man, I'm realizing that I have to be very thoughtful about what it is I do, and it's going to have to be something that will serve my family and I. And more importantly, as a fire chief, I want to make sure that I'm the right fit for that organization. As you've heard here today, I have some thoughts and opinions, and not everybody's going to resonate with what I have to say. And so the organization has to be in need of what I'm going to provide, if that makes any sense.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Okay. And this last question popped up because I saw, I'm looking at your wall that it keyed in.
Oh.
What is your take on education and experience when it comes to the fire service? And I only ask because I am a firm believer, like if you go out and you get the education, you get that paperwork, that doctorate, that master's, that I'm not shying. I'm not trying to throw stones at anybody. Like, that's great. But for me, I believe depending on the position you're in, that's where it comes in handy. And what I mean by that is, like, if you're a captain that has a master's degree, fantastic. Do I believe a captain, a line officer that's on the truck needs to have that? My personal opinion, no. But I think when you start climbing the ranks into the chief officer role, assistant, deputy, fire chief, where you're dealing with budgets, city council, mayors, town boards, whatever. That's where I think, yeah, you might want to start looking at that. So, what's your take on that?
So I have a similar perspective to you. And it's kind of funny because I told you earlier, I was working on my bachelor's when I was on rescues, right? So young in my career. And then I was an engineer, driving engine 39, working on my master's degree. And that in and of itself didn't make a lot of sense. But for me, it was, I want to get this done because I don't want to mess with it later, right? And I was in the groove, I was going to school, I was hustling. At that point, it made sense to me. Now, I had a buddy of mine, good friend of mine, kind of give me the like, what the fuck, man? Like, you don't need that. And I was like, well, I kind of was taking my hair was blown back a little bit when I had hair. Like, my hair was blown back because I was like, oh, well, I'm just trying to improve myself. And that's the thing is that we all have different needs. And We need to be growing commensurate to what our desires are, right? And I didn't know at the time that I wanted to be a chief officer, but I did know that I wanted to continue to grow. And I was like, well, I don't know, a degree will help me in some way. I don't know exactly, I didn't even know what way yet, right? But I knew that that work of doing that, the process of education, will strengthen and grow me. So I was willing to do that, and whatever the results were would come later. And so that was for me the process. Now, did it help me as a company officer? Not directly, but it helped me indirectly when you start talking about things like writing reports and doing research and participating in other things, like not in the fire station per se, but participating in committees and doing research for the organization. And that helped open doors for me. So there's elements of education that are outside of the day in and day out of being a company officer or an engineer or firefighter, right? It helps you just globally. And then I will say that when you start getting in, if you have any aspirations to be a chief officer, or you say, hey, I don't know if I want to be a chief officer, but I want to make sure that I've set the table for myself, then go to school. Just keep going. You don't have to go like full time, take a class at a time. Just slowly trickle charge, right? And just slowly feed that machine. And what in it, what I will say this is that there's nothing in any of my educational programming that has directly affected my day in and day out, right? I didn't go to a class that was like, here's budgeting 101. And then I sat down, I was like, oh my God, here's how it works, right? But what it did do was give me a lot of practice at doing research and reading. And I know that sounds kind of silly, but it opened my eyes to where to get information, how to process information, how to ask good questions. And then when I sat down and started learning how to do budgets, et cetera, I have a different perspective on what that looks like. So, and how to approach it and different project management approaches, et cetera. So I think it's absolutely necessary for your command officers to go and can get education. I think you start that when you're on the line, working your way through, and it'll have some effects, but they'll be a little bit more transient and not as direct.
Okay. All right. And lastly, when you decide to hang it all up, where would you like to see yourself?
You mean like
I
where in the
mean,
country? I'd like to be on a beach.
I mean, it could be that too, but like your final title, which I believe like you will definitely move towards the fire chief step, but just where would you like to see yourself before you decide, hey, it's my time. I've done everything I've needed for the fire service, but it's time for me to go.
So that's a hard question. I don't really know yet exactly. I know that I can say this, I'd like to be a fire chief. I know that now. I'd like to be a fire chief in a place where I can have an impact. And this is going to sound horrible, but I don't want to go to a fire department where I'm just holding the line and we're doing the same thing we've always done and we're not growing, we're not changing, we're not shifting. I don't want to do that. That's not interesting to me. I'd like to go to an organization where there's some expansion happening, some change happening, some dynamic needs in the organization, and then the real challenge of trying to help that organization be successful and help the men and women in that organization reach their full capacity and potential. That's what I'd like to do. And so as long as I can keep doing that or have that be part of the matrix, then when I hit around 65-ish, I'll hit the ripcord and call it a day. So I see myself working to about that age. I'm 54 now, so another 10 years-ish. And I'd like to get as much done in that time as possible. And what exactly that is, I don't know. I don't know exactly where it lands, but
And no, there's nothing wrong that you stated earlier, like that's going to sound wrong. No, it's not. Like, because if you're an organization that's just the good old boys club where we're just maintaining, we've always done it this way, to me, you're failing the fire service because as the fire service changes, technology, fire behavior, building construction, I also believe fire departments have to change because, like, if you're just staying in that stagnant wheel, nobody, it's the same thing year round, you're not growing. And actually, your water's becoming more stagnant. So don't apologize for that.
Well, I don't apologize for that. I apologize for not wanting to be there. I don't want to work in that
I
organization.
got you.
And
I
no
got
shade to
you.
somebody who does, I guess, is my point.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, Chief, I appreciate you taking time out of your day to do this. I like to give whenever I can remember shout outs and credits when it's due. I'm not sure how you met with this individual, but Chief Chris Stewart was the one that put me in contact with you. Awesome, phenomenal dude. He gets a he might get some flack, maybe not to his face, because of who he's aligned himself with within the fire service. You know, the whole voodoo word of blue card, but he was awesome. I love the interview. I love the perspective and conversations we had. He directed me towards you, so I have to say thank you for taking my phone call and coming on Talk Shop. Don't ever change, because in my opinion, we need more chiefs that are gonna be vocal. Like, I understand chiefs need to be politicians at times, but you also need to remember, hey, I'm a firefighter too. My title's changed, but I'm still a firefighter. The men and women are my priority. So, Chief, don't ever change. I like people who aren't the norm. You know what I mean? Like, we need people in positions that aren't always status quo. They're a little bit eccentric, but I love it.
No one's ever called me eccentric. I love that. I will tell you, Chris Stewart was one of my mentors. And what I'll tell you is, he poured into me. He was one of the guys who taught me that ideal of feeding into those who are coming behind you. And I don't know if he told you, but I do a podcast called the Fireground Fitness Podcast.
Okay. Hey,
And
a shameless plug. Throw that out there.
So, but what's interesting about that was my responsibility at the Command Training Center was because of Stewart. I said, "Hey man, I want to do more in this organization." He goes, "You want to go work at the Command Training Center?" He made that happen. And then a few years later, I was like, "I want to be a chief officer." And he's like, "Okay." And next thing you know, I'm getting a phone call. "Hey, do you want to come be the do you want to work out of class as the division chief of special operations?" Okay, right. So he kept thrusting me into uncomfortable learning opportunities, and then be like, "You good?" So it's people like that that we have in our lives that continue to lift us up. He points me to you and says, "Hey, go do a podcast with Danny." I'm like, "Okay." Right. Like, so every time we have these opportunities, you get put in front of people, we need to raise our hand and say, "Yes, please put me in, coach," because that is where you get the growth opportunities. So I remember when I was, and this was a young lesson I learned in the Marine Corps. Guys are like, "Man, never, never volunteer for anything because that'll find you doing the shittiest things." But I discovered that the exact opposite is true. When they come down and say, "Hey, we need some folks for something," it exposes you to new people, exposes you to new things, and you find yourself going places and doing things that you wouldn't have otherwise had an opportunity to do. And that changes the course of your life. So when you don't be afraid to ask people for stuff. I went to my boss and I went to Chris and I said, "Hey, I want to be a chief officer." And he's like, "Oh, okay." And he's like, "Playbook." He knew what he was. "I got some things to put in your place." And that helped shape and push me into different places. So, you need people in your life like that. And he's one of them. That's great.
Absolutely. That mentorship, we talked about that earlier. Okay. All right. And the podcast, the name of it, where can people listen to it? Because I always like to help, but it's the
Oh,
brotherhood.
yeah.
That's what we do.
Yeah, so the Fireground Fitness podcast, it's on all the popular platforms, all the standard, Spotify, Apple, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, Fireground Fitness podcast. We just hit episode 112, and yeah, it's fun. It's been a journey. It's the history of that real quick. I started, you talk about fitness. It started as a blog, and it was just I was putting workouts on there, firefighter-oriented workouts. And as I was promoting and moving around and whatever, it became more difficult to get people to play with me and to take pictures and do the fun stuff. And then I found myself working at the Command Training Center. And when I was at that location, there's all these deputy chiefs and assistant chiefs and all these senior organizational members coming and going. And they were having conversations about stuff that I'd never heard before, stuff that we don't talk about at the kitchen table, just high level organizational history and organizational dynamics and fireground dynamics and things like that that we just weren't talking about. And so I said to Chief Stewart, I said, "Hey man, we should probably start a podcast, man, because this is a conversation that everybody needs to hear." And he goes, "Yeah, you should do that." And I was like, "Who, me? I'm not doing that. No way." And so a few years later, I finally my grew enough hair on my chin and said, all right, I'm gonna do this, and started the Fireground Fitness podcast. So I just morphed the blog, started a podcast, called it the same thing. And the conversation is not just about fitness. It's about all the things that we do in the fire department: health and wellness, physical fitness, mental fitness, tactics and strategies. It's just all things pertaining to life on and off the fire ground. So all the stuff we do.
Love
And
it.
plug over.
Love it. Love it.
Thanks, Danny. Thanks for letting
No,
me get that.
absolutely, Chief. Like I said, thank you for coming on, taking time out of your day to do this. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. I hope the listeners will too.
No. Well, hey, Danny, I thank you, man, because it's conversations like this that help us unpack some of the uncomfortable truths and help us move forward in what we're trying to accomplish here. We have to be getting outside of our own walls, listening to other voices, and really challenging what we think we know, and shaping our operational paradigm because it's shifting. So we have to be looking at it. So I appreciate you having this conversation, inviting me on to talk and share my crazy thoughts and whatever they might be. And I appreciate it, man. Thank you for the time.
No, thanks, sir. Thank you. I appreciate you.
If any of the listeners out there are or know of a great firefighter who embodies the principles of being a great communicator, goal-oriented, hardworking, humble, passionate, and professional, regardless of rank, career, or volunteer, contact me at studentofthegamefirepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, stay focused, stay committed, and stay safe.